Welcome to Hydrofeminist Meditations, a listening series brought to you by Ensayos. Ensayos is a collective research practice born 10 years ago in Tierra del Fuego, at the southernmost tip of South America. Our work is dedicated to understanding the ecopolitics of archipelagos. We ask ethical questions inspired by the places we love. We ally with scientists and communities in the work of conserving and caring for precarious ecosystems. What we do is bring art and environmental humanities into the process of conservation. I'm your host, Catalina Jaramillo. Episode 3 is set in the Americas, in Chile and in New York. In this episode, we think with wetlands. We squish through them in real life and in our imaginations. Preserving turberas, or peat bogs, is a major concern of the Wildlife Conservation Society, an NGO based in New York that manages a huge expanse of land in Tierra del Fuego. We are collaborating with them on that mission. Contributors to this episode live in Santiago, Valdivia, and Papudo in Chile, and in Aminia, New York. We work across North and South America, or from an indigenous perspective, Turtle Island and Abya Yala. This requires time, translation, and patience. We delight in the gaps, failures, and excesses of this process. We experiment with lending each other our ears and our voices to create a chorus, many forms of naming the things that we love and care for. Act 1. Turba Tol, Heart of Peat. Hemani Molina is a Xelgnam writer, poet, craftswoman, and grandmother. She's the president of the Xelgnam Corporation Chile, which was formed 5 years ago. The Xelgnam people are one of four communities indigenous to Tierra del Fuego. Hemani's grandfather's generation were the last Xelgnam people to live freely and practice their culture on the archipelago. He was removed from Tierra del Fuego as a young child in the final chapter of a long cultural genocide. The corporation she directs gathers Xelgnam descendants who have maintained ancestral knowledge over the generations. They aim to dislodge the community from the stigma of extinction. The community celebrated a major success this past June. The Chilean House of Representatives approved the first step of the process that will legally recognize the Xelgnam as a living indigenous community. Hemani collaborates with Ensayos and the Wildlife Conservation Society to influence policies that protect her homeland. Let's hear her heartfelt manifesto.
Corazón de turba. Turba Atol. Mucho se dice de la conservación, la biodiversidad, la sostenibilidad y otros bellos conceptos a veces inalcanzables.
Conservation, biodiversity, sustainability. These are beautiful concepts, but their meanings aren't always accessible to everyday people. In the past, my elders, my ancestors, did not talk about biodiversity, or about conservation, or about defending the environment. To them, these concepts would be incomprehensible. They lived in communion with their environment, and today, the same environment is considered endangered. They were part of the landscape, and that's how they understood it. This is why they never took from nature if there was no real need for it. They didn't hoard things or keep things for the future, because Mother Earth always provided what was necessary for life at the time and place in which it was required. Men only hunted in order to feed and dress himself, never to accumulate furs as a sign of wealth. Neither did people pick all the fruits of a tree, because they had to allow the birds and animals of the forest to feed themselves. The remaining fruits were left to ripen, fall to the ground, and germinate once more, securing nourishment for the future and allowing nature to run its course. The ancestors knew this and respected each season, each cycle, and each process.
Hoy en día la simpleza de lo cotidiano ya no tiene importancia. La sabiduría
Today, quotidian simplicity has lost its importance. The wisdom of those who live on the land, who coexist with the wind, with snow, and with history, is invisible to the eyes and conscience of the rest of the world. Humankind's arrogance has led to over-categorization, using far-fetched and impractical terms that the general population doesn't fully understand. This is why people avoid great crusades and campaigns. They don't understand the explanations being given and don't feel that they are part of the problem. Death should not be described in such runabout ways. If we understand the dimension of death, then we can appreciate the dimension of what life really means. It's right there, before our eyes, and yet we are still unable to see it. When I learned about the peat bogs of Tierra del Fuego, I didn't give them the importance they deserved. Peat bogs was a term that I associated with other things. But when I realized that peat bogs were related to wetlands, my antennas perked up and I dedicated myself to looking for information.
Nací en la ciudad de Valdivia y los humedales que allí existen son impresionantes, maravillosos.
I was born in the city of Valdivia, and the wetlands that exist there are impressive, marvelous, filled with life, and always in danger, threatened by the greed and ignorance of an unscrupulous few. It's been this way ever since I can remember. Only after I understood that I was dealing with a close relative and practically a twin of these wetlands, did I begin to open my eyes, my mind, and my heart. I felt the need to get to know them, to caress them, to speak with them, and to tell everyone what my heart had heard. I realized that little or nothing is known about the peat bogs and how the consequences of their destruction could affect the planet. Regular people, those who shop at the supermarket, those who spend their lives working hand to mouth, those who pay taxes and never question what the television is telling them, those people know nothing about peat bogs. Most people aren't familiar with the term or where they are located. They are like me just a little while ago. A discussion of peat bogs goes beyond just talking about Mother Nature's wisdom. As an almost imperceptible part of romantic landscapes, they hide an entire world and their own method of balancing the ecosystem. They literally feed off what kills us, carbon, among other substances. This is why I compare them to a gigantic liver in this beautiful body that belongs to the greatest being I know, our planet. One of the greatest challenges I've taken on was to represent my people at the COP25 Minga in Madrid, Spain in 2019. Indigenous people from all over the world gave presentations on environmental issues, and I noticed that little was said about the peat bogs that exist throughout the world. The ones in Tierra del Fuego have captured my heart, but all of them, absolutely all of them, deserve to be known and protected. How to explain this simply? A peat bog is a type of wetland where peat accumulates, and peat is nothing but a layer of decaying organic matter that has built up over thousands of years. In an unseen dance between many components, these decaying plants become carbon trappers that maintain biodiversity. Peat bogs store large quantities of fresh water, and they conserve organic matter for so long that they are also great protectors of archaeological patrimony. They are like living museums, we must not take anything from them because they speak to us from the past and protect the ecosystem for the future. In addition to this, they are habitats for innumerable species of flora and fauna.
La explotación de las turberas constituye un gran peligro en el ecosistema y la biodiversidad para las generaciones futuras.
The exploitation of peat bogs endangers the ecosystem and threatens biodiversity for future generations. Sadly, and for some time now, peat bogs have suffered due to human activities. Peat is used for water purification systems and as a soil fertilizer. And what's worst, it's being concessioned for mining and the extraction of fresh water. What is the point? To stop regarding peat bogs as a commodity that produces wealth would be a solution, but it's already too late for that. Human beings don't easily let go of something that offers financial gain. The truth is that there should be policies in place to protect peat bogs in Chile. Both productive and extractive uses should be regulated since avoiding exploitation is nearly impossible. These policies should be based on science that is explained in clear, simple, and effective language. That way, when a housewife goes to the supermarket and sees beautiful potted plants with soil labeled as peat, she will understand that if she buys one, she is supporting a business that is slowly killing the planet. A human being without a liver dies. A human being with sick kidneys dies. The planet without peat bogs, without wetlands, and without conscientious humans will suffer the same fate. We will suffer along with it as living beings and part of the ecosystem. My heart beats stronger today because I'm conscious that everything will be different from this day forward. I will no longer look at the landscape with the same eyes. It will no longer be just a beautiful setting for taking a picture or for depicting in an oil painting or a poem. From this day on, the beating of my heart will be in sync with that of the peat bogs, because as long as we keep on pounding loudly, we can hope to live on for many generations.
Act 2. My house is a ship turned upside down. Christy Gast is an artist who works in textiles, sculpture, and performance. She's one of the founding members of Ensayos. The Wildlife Conservation Society invited her to join their 7th marine expedition to Admiralty Sound in Tierra del Fuego as artist in residence a few years ago. She traveled with marine biologists and park rangers. The boat was their home and laboratory for 10 days. It was an intimate, sensorial research experience, typical of Ensayos. In this piece, Christy wonders how field-based research can happen at home in the times of COVID.
It's early 2016, and I'm in the cabin of a wooden boat built and operated by a band of cousins from Chiloé, an archipelago in northern Patagonia, in Chile. 10 of us, scientists, sailors, me, the expedition's artist in residence, left for Tierra del Fuego yesterday. We are heading to Almirantazgo Fjord. There, a long glacial valley meets the sea. The boat's diesel engine deliberately pushes us up one tall wave after another. The big waves roll rhythmically moved by an unseen force. They feel almost geological in their regularity. Artists speak of raking light, beamed at an object from an oblique angle to reveal textures that might otherwise go unseen. Here on the water, Tierra del Fuego's famous winds hit the big waves sideways. These raking winds create a diagonal pattern of smaller, white-tipped waves that cover the surface of the swells we're climbing. And these waves on waves contain their own geometric texture of surface ripples that catch the late summer light like fish scales. These waves on waves on waves appear as a nested configuration. In ecological science, nestedness is a concept that refers to ever smaller habitats that are held within larger ones. Worlds within worlds within worlds. Spring 2020, Armenia, New York. A pandemic is raging in the region where I live. I can't sleep, so I'm stargazing on a wooden picnic table behind my house. The picnic table sits on top of a septic field, which is part of the system that filters my house's gray water. Just behind the septic field, the elevation dips slightly. Snowmelt has pooled in an enormous puddle there and in the other backyards along my road. These seasonal wetlands annoy my neighbors, but right now they're so full of life. A chorus of frogs and toads have just awoken from hibernation. The moon silhouettes the tall, sloped roof of my house. It looks like a ship turned upside down. Creaking floorboard up here in the attic reminds me of the groans of the fishing boat as it climbed the waves, and the song the chef sang as he burst into the cabin during a squall. Onde va la lancha? During the last ice age, the spot where this house sits was under a mile-thick glacier. It receded 15,000 years ago, leaving behind a long, boggy valley. 120 years ago, the wetland was partially filled in to build a row of Victorian houses. This house was built before the town had running water. The house was designed to be its own water catchment system. The sloped roof directed rainwater to a cistern in the cellar, interrupting its ancient path towards the wetland, towards the sea. My house is a ship turned upside down. The water flows through the house instead of the other way around.
Onde va la lancha? It's summer now, a hot, muggy afternoon, and I'm sitting in the cellar in the cistern. It's a pit excavated into a wetland. And it's not used to store water anymore, but it's the coolest place in the house. I can still see the water line on the cistern's walls. This visual marker is a memory of water. The water line reminds me of a striking excavation we witnessed during Ensayo's first expedition to the Almirantazgo Fjord. We were traveling by land. Our 4x4 pickup truck struggled to climb Tierra del Fuego's steep gravel slopes. We used the new road, which was still under construction. The road builders had sliced a trench through the soft peat bog to lay the roadbed on firm ground. Peat consists of decayed wetland plants and mosses. It builds up at a rate of about 1 millimeter per year and stores carbon and other minerals from the atmosphere. Peat is a geological memory bank. The excavated section we passed through was about 6 meters high, 6,000 years worth of information. It was charcoal colored towards the bottom, orange towards the top, and green at the surface where it was still growing. Water wept out of it, continuing along its ancient path towards the sea. Although my house no longer functions as a water catchment system, groundwater still seeps into the cistern on its way to the sea. It trickles across the cellar floor and into a hole. When the hole fills, the sump pump is triggered, sending water through a pipe to the wetland.
I look at this wetland every day, but I've never stepped foot into it until now. It's modest, tucked between these houses, nested, you could say. Main features are Phragmites, that grass that covers wastelands all over the world, cattails, some small willows and viburnum. Is it a peatland? Minimum organic matter would be 12 inches thick. I have a shovel. Oh. It looks promising. The road is a major feature. It's the main road through the valley, and I imagine it predates the town's settlement in the late 1700s. Before then, Pequot and Shattuck people cared for this land. It's another world in here. I can hardly move, and I can't see beyond the reeds. My house is gone. And I think of the similarities and differences between this wetland and the Turbera. An idea of nestedness. Ever smaller habitats held within larger ones. Not in the strict sense like islands further from the mainland, but especially now that we're not traveling, not sharing the same space, I'm thinking of nestedness as going deeper into the ecologies of our bodies, our homes and communities, these unexotic, mundane places that we all have in common. And looking for unfolding relationships with other places and times, sheltering in place, ensayoing in place.
Act 3. There are a lot of turberas in Caruquinca Natural Park in Tierra del Fuego. Dr. Bárbara Saavedra is the director of the Wildlife Conservation Society in Chile, which directs the park. She's a biologist who specializes in ecology and conservation and a founding member of Ensayos. Dr. Saavedra advocates for peatland conservation and has created a roadmap for how Chile should do this. Christy Gast interviewed her to find out how it's going.
Onde va la lancia, la turbera? Onde va la lancia, la turbera?
It is fantastic. I really love it because it is connected with your lancha, remember? And also the idea of getting to the turbera by lancha is a good thing because people tend to think as these ecosystems to be all different and disconnected.
Imagine that you're standing in a peat bog. What do you see?
So when I think in peatlands, one of my favorite spots in the world, the La Paciencia Valley, which is a deep valley covered by peatlands, different colors, oranges, greens, yellows, water everywhere. And when you smell the peat, it smells alive. They smell fresco, as is in Spanish. Very fresh. They store massive amounts of water, but cover a very small fraction of the surface, like 3%. And they not only store water like any wetland, but also they store massive amounts of carbon in the substrate that they have, which is called peat.
Can you explain what is carbon sequestration?
You know, peatlands are like a terrestrial iceberg where we see only the top layer, which are these mosses. But under the surface, it is a very deep, profound, and thick accumulation of organic matter. Some are over 100 meters embedded in the earth. What the mosses do is they do photosynthesis and they capture CO2 and transform it into living material, their living material, the Sphagnum magellanicum, which is the most important moss in peatlands, they grow very, very fast. So they are very good in capturing carbon and sequestrating the carbon from the atmosphere and leaving it stuck in their own plant structure. And when they die, their bodies remain as part of the peat. So the carbon that was captured remains in the peatland. So it is basically a machine that sequestrates carbon. That's why they are so significant when you think in structures to mitigate. So if we do really want to cool down our planet, the most effective way to do it is to bring nature back and allow it to do what it has been doing for millions of years, which is taking the carbon from the atmosphere and transforming it into bodies.
Now, I understand that humans also sequester carbon, and I was wondering what else we might have in common with peat.
There are several things that connect us as humans with peatlands. First of all, we are both almost entirely made out of water. And we cannot tell because we don't see, we don't feel that, but our bodies are mostly water, as it is with peatlands. And the difference there is that you can see the water there. The other thing is what you mentioned, the humans as well as peatlands are in the reality a net of so many different organisms that are connected and that share one common space. In the case of humans, we have more cells of species that are different from humans in our bodies, more DNA that comes from other species in our bodies than our own DNA, because we have a lot of bacteria and viruses in our stomach, in our mouth, in our genitals, our eyes, our hair. And the same thing with peatlands, that they have not only different species of plants, the mosses and lichens and other things, but also in the substrate, there are all these networks of microbes that live embedded in this body. It is not a simple body like our own body, but a more complex body that is the habitat for different communities of species. Most of them are very small organisms and microbes and viruses and other small, tiny animals. So, yes, we share all that.
So when you do conservation work, it's inherently interdisciplinary because you are talking to scientists from different fields who are studying similar things, so that you can get a global understanding of the importance of the issue that you're working on. And you also talk to these stakeholders. And with Thensaios, we've been bringing art into the picture. Why do you think interdisciplinary work matters?
Recently, there has been the mining extraction of the peat, and that destroys the peatland as a whole. They drain it, they get the peat out of the ecosystem, and it doesn't recover. These austral ecosystems are being destroyed to produce flowers that are being sold in cities in Europe. People that have very nice balconies with tulipans or other flowers are not aware that for them to have that tulipan, some very significant ecosystems for the people in Patagonia and for the world as a whole, because of this ability of peatlands to sequestrate carbon, they don't see those relationships. Conservation is about making them aware of that. And being aware is not enough. Is to transform their decisions and to commit themselves to conserve not only their own tulipans if they want to, but to maintain life integrity in our planet. And Sayos is interesting because all this thing happens at different scales, and we need to address or to develop new tools to change legal issues, understanding, to develop financial tools to be able to provide the needed resources to do these works at different levels. We need to build capacity. We need to transform industries. There are so many things that need to be transformed in order to be able to achieve real conservation at this multi-scale. And to be able to do that, we need to deal with diversity. And we need to deal with all sorts of connections and all these different worlds. And Ensayos is all about that. Offering the space to make those connections, to deeply understand, to deeply connect, and from there, transform.
Act 4, a flavor for peat. Can you imagine losing your sense of smell? This is one of the symptoms of COVID-19. Ensayos has explored the sense of smell in order to communicate with beavers in Tierra del Fuego. That's right, we want to communicate with beavers using scent. Beavers were brought to Tierra del Fuego by people, but now we say they don't belong. They flood forests and dig channels through peat bogs to make their homes. The government of Chile and Argentina believe that eradicating beavers will protect the ecosystem. And Sayos wondered what beavers have to say about that. So we followed their lead and developed a series of scents for an olfactory experiment. Did it work? The results were inconclusive. Anyway, back to your nose. Camila Marambio, who founded Ensayos, will take us on a guided tour of the olfactory system. I encourage you to close your eyes and follow her voice. Sniff your way into the inner wetlands of your body.
Life began in the sea, and she exerts a powerful influence on us. We receive information about flavors through a watery medium that bathes the nose, the mouth, and the throat. Smell and taste, the essence of excitement, stimulates us through molecules that carry chemical information. These molecules may dissolve, but they rarely combine. We taste with our mouths and smell with our noses, yet we assess pungency, texture, mouthfeel, and all such nuances as a totality, a second nature. Several body fluids correspond fairly closely to the composition of the sea. During the period when life forms first left it to inhabit the land, the brain itself is afloat in one such medium, a sophisticated internal hydraulic cushion, or waterbed if you like, in which the brain's hormones circulate. The moon influences the tides. There are many such rhythms in our body chemistry, of which one of the most important is called the alkaline cycle. While we sleep, carbon dioxide accumulates in the blood from energy metabolism, raising the acid content within. When we get up and start our morning activities, this excess acid is blown off as we breathe. This product of digestion and the activities of the liver and the kidney ensure a regular rise and fall in this cycle every 24 hours. This tide affects our perception of flavor. For example, if you are just waking up now and I ask you to smell this imaginary peat bog I'm standing in, the brown material consisting of partly decomposed vegetable matter might strike you as refreshing, even aphrodisiac. But if night has fallen and you can't see the surrounding wetland, but only smell it, you might find it spicy and intoxicating. The rising and setting of the sun creates the light-dark cycle that controls circadian rhythms. Many other hormones, the chemical messengers of the body, show a similar rhythm. The hormones of the steroid miracle are an unwieldy long chain of carbon molecules first found in the ray-type fish. They form a substantial part of the skin surface lipids and are known now to have a morning tidal peak. Take a deep sniff of your own morning breath and find the base notes of the decaying matter that has been piling up for over 12,000 years, building an ecosystem so rich that it smells old, astringent. The peat bog inside of you, it may smell of strong black tea, wet animal hide, oak bark in the rain, delicious umami. In the beginning, in the water, there was a single cell with the ability to pass molecules back and forth through its wall. It was able to differentiate between particles and choose which ones to bind with. Humans have a negative response to 80% of our odor input. Probably a remnant of those early tastings when most of the offerings were toxic. Those cells best able to recognize the difference thrived and grouped together at the same time as they developed the ability to move around, avoiding and seeking out particles. From this, we can discern the basis of the sensory and motor components of the nervous system and the beginnings of memory. The smell brain and the taste brain developed at an early stage in our marine evolution. As smell, taste, memory, and intelligence became integrated, an accompanying emotional dimension emerged, or so is said. A warning. The relatively bigger brains of humans that resulted from standing up, using hearing and vision, and developing a forelimb with the opposable thumb, now rely less on odor than at any previous evolutionary state. The tissues inside of the nose contain a myriad of free nerve endings that perceive pain and irritation, plus sensors for hot and cold, all of which contribute to our idea of smell. There is a patch of yellow-brown lining at the top of the roof of the nose. It covers an area of about 5 square centimeters with a deep cleft on either side. This is the olfactory epithelium. It contains up to 50 million odor receptor cells that are constantly changing, maturing, and deteriorating. There's still no accepted explanation of exactly how we detect smells, but to understand the range of olfactory performance, it helps to know that our furry kin, say, a German Shepherd dog, has perhaps 40 times this number. Each odor receptor cell may respond to several odors, and it seems that the brain recognizes a particular quality of an odor not in the activity of one cell, but in a pattern or code from the activity of many. What's more, as they modify and regenerate, cells may change the odors to which they respond. This could have a bearing on the baffling alterations in flavor that we perceive from time to time. We usually smell with one side of the nose at a time, cycling between 20 minutes and 4 hours. We sniff with both nostrils, unaware that one is often left out. Quiet, normal breathing does not quite offer the exposure to smells from the outside world that a good sniff does, when it presents turbulent streams of warmed air for examination. What is known about the actual mechanism of olfaction is that the smell molecules dissolve in the fluid around the olfactory cell whiskers, stimulating the hair-shaped appendages to fire off electrical messages to the brain in response to the shape of the odor molecules, to the vibrations they set up, to the differing intensities of odor, to the patterns of particles presenting themselves at different times during the sniff. From the pickup area on the roof of the nose, the first relay station is the olfactory bulb inside the skull. Nerve fibers pass through the fine holes in a thin plate of bone. The next relay station is the smell brain itself, with its graceful curves of extraordinary complexity. One can only guess at the reason for this shape. The smell brain enfolds the hypothalamus, like some creature of the deep, guarding exquisite treasure hidden in a cave. This olfactory cortex is the oldest section of the limbic system, a complex system of nerves and networks in the brain. The limbic system controls the basic emotions of fear, pleasure, anger, and drives hunger, sex, dominance, care. Because of the intimate anatomical association between the hypothalamus, the olfactory cortex, and the limbic system, they are usually described as a unit, comprising in large part of the amygdala, the hippocampus, the associated cortex, the thalamus, and the hypothalamus pituitary complex. The hippocampus is the library of long memory. If you want to visit this library, all you have to do is sniff your own skin. Close your eyes. Inhale deeply. And travel to the archive of water inside you.
Act 5. Remember, on the Valalancha, we sing songs, folk songs, sea shanties, kids' ditties, pop hits, anything to keep conservation questions flowing in the world. Camila invited a family of talented musicians from her hometown, a fishing village on the coast of Chile, to record our version of this Chilote classic. Get on board. This boat is heading to the Turbera.
Turbera, turbera, por amor la lancha se va. Turbera, De pronto una niña se acerca al pasar, pregunta en voz alta la lancha dónde va. De pronto una niña se acerca al pasar, pregunta en voz alta la lancha dónde va.
Joining us on this hydrofeminist meditation. We hope you have enjoyed season one of this listening series. We look forward to sharing more smells, stories, and songs during season two. We're all bodies of water. What we do to water, we do to everybody, including ourselves. If you want to know more about Ensayos, go to www.ensayostierradelfuego.net.
Hydrofeminist Meditations was produced by Ensayos during a residency at the New Museum of Contemporary Art. The Norwegian Consulate and the Australia Council for the Arts provided additional support. This episode was created by Christy Gast, Camila Marambio, Gemani Molina, Barbara Saavedra, with Elisito Balbutin, Ariel Bustamante, Fuente Papuro, Pablo Tierman, Nico Torres, Red Submarine Recording Studio, Carolyn Tampere, Caitlin Franzman, and Catalina Jaramillo. Special thanks to Elena Betros Lopez, Wildlife Conservation Society Chile, Caroquinca Natural Park, the Emilia Conservation Advisory Council, Sharon Jewell and Carla Machiavello, Manuela Baldovino for her translations, Dr. Max Lake for his book Sense and Sensuality, and Emily Miller from the New Museum. Music is by Vera Dvall. We are all bodies of water are the wise words of Astrida Nimanes.